For many people, electronics on their own are, they just kind of sit there. They don't really do much, they don't pop, they're not as interesting as when you put them into other devices. And so some makers out there, they take electronics and they put them into mixed media, maybe with leatherwork or sewing or knitting or really any of the crafting techniques that are out there. People like our guest today, Becky Stern, take electronics and then integrate them into that craft mindset. And I really love to be able to watch electronics, which of course I love, and you probably do too, and then see them being used in an interesting and unexpected way. And Becky's project page is a great example of this. She has tutorials from the many, many years she's been doing electronics designing and crafting, and you can go and follow along. Becky is also a prolific documenter of all the things that she does. And so, like I said, you can go and follow her site, you can see all the things she's building, and then you can take those directions and build them yourself. So today we're gonna talk to Becky not only about the electronics she's putting into things and how she makes the everything else around those electronics, but also the nature of documenting and how to make a good tutorial that other people can follow and use so that they can make the same things you're making. So I hope you enjoy this show with Becky Stern about making and mixed media and electronics. Becky, welcome to the Contextual Electronics Podcast. Can you tell me a little bit about yourself and what you like building in your free time? Your all time.
Sure. Yeah, thanks for having me. Yeah, my all time. I am Becky Stern. I'm a maker and a builder and a tinkerer. I like arts and crafts as well as electronics. So I make a lot of tutorial projects for folks to see my process where I'm often combining electronics and crafts or just doing crafts or just doing electronics as well. So I really like photography and videography too. So that's where some of my perhaps over documentation penchant comes from, is that I dabble in all these different creative media, including the photo and video, and therefore publish a lot. So I've got hundreds of tutorials you can follow from, you know, basic, really basic skill level stuff to advanced projects that bring a lot of disciplines together. So that's me. I live in Brooklyn, New York, so I've also got a small space thing going on. My workshop is just one of the bedrooms in my apartment building. So, you know, working with what I got here and making mostly Apple Crate sized or smaller objects.
That's great. That's great. Yeah. And I've followed your work for a very long time. I really like how you're able to, you know, one of the things that we like focusing on the Contextual Electronics Podcast is people putting electronics to use. And I think that you've already kind of alluded to that. It's not just the electronics for the electronics sake. It's also going into interesting things. And I think that fusion of electronics and, you know, to make a craft light up or to augment a craft or to augment, you know, workspace or just a thing that you want to have out in the world is really powerful in that way. How do you go about actually thinking about what you're going to put into a project? Do you start with the electronic side? Do you start with the craft side? Where do you start to build an idea out?
It usually starts just with one aspect of the project and then layers might build on from there. So, I would say, I don't know, I have a recent project that's like a constellation embroidery that'll be out by the time this podcast is out, that where the idea was like to showcase how you can sew LEDs with conductive thread. So the impetus for the project is more of a skill I want to teach, and then the project is a means to get there. And then sometimes I have a very utilitarian need for like a piece of furniture in my house, and I might as well share the process so that I can, you know, feed the hungry content machine.
Yeah, it is relentless, isn't it?
I used to call it the blog monster. When I did a bunch of blog posts for Make Magazine, I think I was on like 6 blog posts a day or something. I used to call it feeding the hungry blog monster.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that's quite a bit. So when you are thinking about this, I mean, do you when you come across a new like electronic side of like electronic gadget or a dev board or technology, is it something that like you start to visualize that's going to be part of your future process?
It's hard to learn new things, right? But I have like collect hobbies sort of compulsively. So I really like doing the 101 and the 201 levels of like almost any type of subject, mm-hmm. whether it's like a Raspberry Pi or the 3D printing or leather working or some other kind of like hands, handicraft. So, but I hit a wall after that usually because I'm very much a generalist. So I can handle a certain amount of a learning curve depending on my motivation. Like, gosh, the knitting machine is a good example of that. It's like a really big pain in the butt to get it all up and working, but it was so cool what the outcome was. If I can't see that outcome, I'm much less motivated to like be able to go to the 301 level. So I don't know. It takes a lot for me to try something that I've never tried before. But if I've even tried it just a little, then I'm usually not afraid to like go deeper.
Okay. All right. And so what is the knitting machine? What did that involve? Like what level of complexity was that? And how did that end up outputting
craft? It involved finding people to collaboratively write a Tandy floppy drive emulator, really, is what it came down to. because the thing was designed to work with the floppy drive. And so that was, as long as the terminal could pretend to be that, it worked out. Uh-huh. So, but that was outside my level of expertise. So it involved collaborating with others, which is also not an introvert's favorite thing to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, that does change the nature of it. But it seems like you have a couple of collaborations on your site of other makers, Stephanie and Naomi, and other people that are prominent in the world of electronics and making and online.
Yeah, I try to make friends. No, those two ladies are excellent and are my friends who, you know, we build each other up and. Especially when we hung out in 2018 was the last time we saw each other in person at Maker Faire. So fond memories of that. And yeah, I think it's really fun to work on a project with somebody else. Like the recent collab I did with Stephanie where we built each other birthday presents, because when you're beholden to somebody else, the project is a different kind of fun, I think. Like if you're making something for yourself, I feel like I'm more hypercritical of myself than I would be of I'm seeing it through someone else's eyes, and it just was like a ton of fun to build. So I just like making gifts. So maybe I should do more content that is geared towards in the end being a gift, because I had such a fun time. But when I make something for myself, it's like, okay, it works. Like I made this Slack status updater, right? It's just a little ESP8266 and a rotary switch to give you a little tactile and easy way to update your Slack status, and made a little like graphic where you can customize what statuses you set, right? But it doesn't work with my corporate workspace. Like my corporate workspace permissions are too restrictive to allow for the API or the app permissions that it needs. And so it's like, oh, okay, well, great. So I made that for myself and now I can't use it. So that was fun. And other people can make it and use it with their less restrictive workspaces, but like, I don't know. Like not as satisfying
I think
bring someone joy.
Yeah. Being the person who gets to use the end thing. I mean, that is kind of the joy of making in the first place, right? Of just being able to use this thing that you've spent this time on. And I think you always, at least when I'm making similar types of things, it's like, oh, I'm the customer. I get to decide, you know, what this is being used for and what the cool output is. So. So one thing that I think is a very constant in a lot of your projects is kind of LEDs and the light aspect. Can you kind of walk me through how you start to think through integrating lighting and like kind of best practices around putting lighting into a lot of your projects?
Yeah, sure. I like LEDs so much more than motors. I'm like motors are outside my wheelhouse. I think of them as totally opposite ends of a spectrum. Uh-huh. I'm also just like not a mechanical, moving mechanisms. So I can do static 3D stuff, but so light is really like more of a playground for me. I think of it as like easy, and maybe it's because I learned Photoshop as a kid. And so like the RGB situation, when I learned how to started learning how to program, seemed really obvious. Oh yeah. Okay. I recognize that from Photoshop. So I already had the language to be able to play with the color of the LEDs in programming, and that inspired quite a few LED projects that I've done over the years. And so I guess when I think about where to put them inside of an object, whether it's like a something you wear or like a an object that you hold or use, a product, something you hang on the wall, is like where you want the light to go. And that, it might sound obvious, but really, like, I visualize the light like bouncing off of things and bouncing off of what's nearby it. Which way is it pointing? What's the viewing angle of the LED that you're using? And do you need some kind of diffusion either in front of it or to the side of it? And then, like, what kind of effect am I trying to create? And then that might dictate what material choices I use for that diffusion. Because really, like, yeah, you can put LEDs out, but you can also point them, like, backwards against something reflective and it'll bounce out. I've also put it behind, like, laser cut, lace looking kind of laser cut panels. If you shine it backwards, you get, like, just sort of this backlight effect. And so I have a tutorial on my site about LED diffusion for folks can check out, like, a bunch of different ideas and materials to try. But it's really just about, like, the feeling I'm trying to make, and then also, like, the space requirements too, because if you're trying to make a really diffused look, you often need more space for the light to bounce around. So there's, like, if you want something to be really flat, maybe you have to compromise on your vision for the outcome. But yeah, I work backwards from the feeling I'm trying to make, and then, like, chip away at it with technical requirements from there, I guess.
Yeah, that's great. And I definitely will link in the 13 ideas for LED diffusion. That's great. I do remember my first time working with LEDs and trying to do, like, a wearable project, and I'm just like, there's, like, these little points of light that doesn't look great, you know? So then I had to basically figure all the stuff out you're talking about here, like the moving things further away or doing a light bounce or something like that. And I imagine that your focus on video and photography as well also helps in that regard.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. Because once you learn lighting, you know how light bounces off of stuff. Yeah. You just kind of, LEDs you have to imagine, and you learn over time, that are, like, really intense point sources of light. Mm-hmm. Photographing and videoing them is also a pain in the butt for that reason. But agreed that my interest in photography and lighting definitely informed how I enjoy working with LEDs. And yeah, point sources. So, like, yeah, the design, if I wanted to make something flat, that we're like, oh, diffusion, maximum diffusion is not really an option. If you're trying to make something super flat, you change the concept. You make it a constellation of stars, which are point sources of light, right? You think of designs that do have point sources of light. You do birthday candles instead of floodlights. And just, like, one more creative angle you got to take. But it does, yeah, there's limits there that often people don't imagine until they run up against trying to build it themselves.
Yeah. Another lesson that I think I learned the hard way was, like, even though RGB and B are all available, people don't like rainbow effects as much as I think they will. I feel like that's, like, a hard one lesson.
We call it sample code. I mean, yeah, right. You walk by, like, a New York City bodega and they have RGB lights that are just going red, green, blue, rainbow. Yeah. And it's like, okay, I see what you did there. Yeah. It's recognizable now as a little bit of a trope, right? And to me, as a person who works with that code, it just looks lazy. It looks beautiful. I actually really like rainbow LED effects, but it looks like you got the library code working and then did not further work on your animation. I teach a class at SVA here in New York, and my students work with NeoPixels. It's their many of them have never done any programming before, and so they do a little Arduino, and it's like a grad product design program, so they're often quite bright and pick up stuff quite quickly, but I have to tell them that
bright LED students.
No pun intended. I have to caution them about that.
Yeah, I mean, it does seem like it is a kind of a learned thing over time. So can you explain for people that are watching or listening that don't understand what a NeoPixel is, like, what is actually internally, what's going on there? Like, what would you tell a student you're teaching, like, about what's going on internal?
Yeah, okay, so addressable LED strip is just a bunch of RGB LEDs with chips inside that help them daisy chain their data so that you can use fewer pins. So it's like a data chain of LEDs that talk to one another, and you can send an address and a color and then that particular pixel in the line can take the code. They relay the code from one pixel to the next, so you can run into issues if you have a poor quality data connection down the line, or one of them is broken, like old school Christmas lights. But depending on the platform, actually, I think there's a new version that has another pin that makes for a little bit more redundancy. But yeah, they're like RGB LEDs with a lot more convenience. You can put many, many, many of them with, you know, so few pins on your microcontroller and such simple code that it's really a very inspiring way for folks who've just done like LEDs and buttons to level up their electronic skills without a lot of learning curve. It's really quite a fun leap I've seen for students to jump into the addressable LED pixels. Mm. Back in my day, yeah, boy, great. Howdy, we didn't have this.
Yeah. Back in my day, we had current sources and we dialed in which the red and the green and the blue were doing themselves, right? So I'm curious about this class you teach as well, because it seems like you said they're master's students as well. So it seems like they're masters of design, you said, or?
Yeah, that's it. It's a MFA program. Yeah. Called Products of Design at SVA. Okay. Yeah.
Mm. Cool. Yeah. And so I would imagine people with a really developed view of the world, right? View of like how things should look versus how they can't, you know, the tools that are available. It sounds like you're helping them develop their tool sets and their, you know, kind of getting started into this new world of LEDs. What are some of the things that are surprising to them that you kind of have to guide them through? So is it like, is it that diffusion piece, or is it the programmability piece? Is it more like the logistical hands-on side? Like what are some of the stumbling blocks of people getting started?
Well, there's two camps usually. There's like a camp of students who find that once they figure out that this is all that is inside their gadgets, that they find it very demystifying and empowering. Mm-hmm. And they're like, well, I understand everything now that I've taken apart a CD player and coded some NeoPixels. Like a lot of new things make sense to them. So it's very empowering. But then there's like another camp that gets hung up on the, and really kind of seems afraid of the coding aspect of it, is very intimidated by programming in general. And like, I see them almost get into their own heads too much, right? Like you psych yourself up, like you're going to go bungee jumping and like your own fear is like the only thing standing in your way. Like I see that when like I pull the for loop up on the screen, the fear. Mm-hmm. And yeah. So like I noticed that like especially as grad students, like I think if you're much younger, if you're like a seventh or eighth grade or high school kid, that like or even I was in college when I learned meaningful programming beyond HTML and Snake game, like it builds a lot of confidence in you. And if you've never tried it before and you've reached adulthood where you find yourself as a complete human who uses a smartphone, and you try to dip your toes into programming and you're afraid of it and you get intimidated, you psych yourself out and you'd be like, it's the complete opposite thing happens. I don't understand anything. I don't understand the world around me at all anymore.
Right.
What is technology?
Yeah, that's a good point.
I'll never understand it. Right. Maybe I'm not cut out for like to be envisioning objects of the future. So that takes a lot of therapy.
For 15 years of electronics experience, I have to say, I still feel like that. I look around, I'm like, how does any of this stuff work at all? Spent time on a bench, just like, my God, like I cannot believe that these computers work. Like it's just, so I feel like that's kind of a universal. So it's just they're welcome to the party, design folks.
It's a little bit of visiting the magical city of Oz and meeting the wizard and him taking you behind the curtain.
That's right. Yeah.
You either are really, really into it or really like shocked. So yeah. Mm-hmm. But I like teaching adults too, because they, that part is fun to me. The like building up of confidence and the psychological part of it, where you can explain that to an adult. Like, look, it's normal to feel uncomfortable while you're doing this. And
welcome to imposter syndrome. The party
yeah,
is
yeah. growing. Congratulations, you learned something about yourself today.
Yeah.
I truly enjoy teaching grad students. I find it really fun.
Yeah, That's great. That's great. And I feel like that, I mean, that programming piece too, it is, I had a very difficult time getting into it myself. And it's just like this thing where people are like, oh, well, it should be so logical. And yet some things are just not logical, especially like if you're coming to, like, you know, now that I've used Arduinos for a long time, I understand some of the quirks of the system, but it's just like, if I looked at that from an outside perspective, to be like, what are you doing? And I am glad that there's people like you that are helping guide people through and making it a little easier, making that path, that transition a little easier.
Yeah. And they're designers. So like some of them will never use the things I teach them again after my class specifically, like they might never touch an Arduino again, or they might. Mm-hmm. And so it really, I think it's important to point out the things that come along with learning that, like what you're likely to get out of that experience beyond just knowing what a for loop is. Mm-hmm. So I lean heavily on that. And I find that a really satisfying part of like watching the journey of students, like versus teaching like a one-off class, you know, like watching them over the course of the whole semester is really rewarding. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's great. So you also have projects on your site that are, and I'm actually going to pull these up here as well. But you also have projects on your site that are more kind of higher level. So like Raspberry Pi style sites mm-hmm. or projects as well. So then how do you start to approach that? And is that something that your students are also doing, or is it just more from your personal projects?
This personal projects, I don't, my students don't have enough time, since I just teach them the one semester, like I don't have enough time mm-hmm. to get them from zero to Raspberry Pi. Although I suppose that's not out of the question if that's where you were going and you were trying to teach them how to make like little web servers mm-hmm. and stuff. Since I'm mm-hmm. focused on allowing them to be able to bring their physical product ideas into the prototype phase. Like if they know how to 3D model, well, why don't they make a works-like prototype with an Arduino board inside? It's not part of my class's purview, which also involves a bunch of like physical making skills to encourage the Raspberry Pi route. But that's not to say that one couldn't, because a simple Raspberry Pi project's not really that hard to get off the ground. If you have the right tutorials and resources, that's the thing. Like the basics of microcontroller coding is so basic and therefore teaches you about how like all computers work, where like the Raspberry Pi, I think, teaches you how to program, but I don't think it's the ideal platform for teaching folks how to light up an LED for the first time yet. Right. Not the full Linux computer board version anyway. Yeah, I tell them no, because I don't feel like debugging their Raspberry Pi projects either, because they're like, I'm going to follow this harebrained tutorial. And I'm like, yeah, there's 18 of you, so no. but that's a practical concern. Raspberry Pi projects pretty challenging myself. I stretch myself with Raspberry Pi projects. I'm not a great programmer. I went to art school myself, not engineering school. I have more programming experience than most art school students, but it's not my forte. So I, when I'm making a Raspberry Pi project, it's usually pretty exploratory for myself. And I feel like for certain subjects, you need to be a certain level more advanced than your students to be able to effectively teach it, especially programming, because mm-hmm. you need to be able to debug their stuff. So, yeah.
Right.
I also don't know Python very well. So like, I don't know if I'm ever going to teach Python. I need to learn it a lot better than I already know it in order to do that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I feel like when you're troubleshooting your own projects is like such a interesting and difficult experience. And then, you know, like having like 18 students who have like just these branching, it's like this branching tree of like everything that can go wrong. And then it's like, well, I did this, this, and this, and can you help me figure it out? And you're like, I don't even know how you got to where you are. Like, why is the Raspberry Pi?
Yes, and
you know, blinking.
I've gotten very good at webcam Arduino project debugging over the last year or so, since we were entirely remote. So it's certainly a lot easier when you're over someone's shoulder and you're able to, in three dimensions, look at their circuit board and say like, oh, your breadboard wire is just one pin over from where it should be. That particular problem is actually really hard to see on the webcam. I have to have them hold it up and then like rotate it, because from one angle, like the parallax could make it seem like it's in a different hole than it actually is. So that particular thing I've learned a lot about, and have done really well. I I got really a lot better at it and felt really good about my debugging over the video conference skills. And, you know, when students are beginners, their problems are not very insurmountable. They're usually like, my wire is one hole off, or I forgot to connect that side of the breadboard to power, or I have one small error in my code. You know, it's like the problems are pretty basic. Right. So that part is good. It's true when I have a really intrepid student who takes on absorbs some resource material they found on the internet that didn't come from me, and that is like, it can be challenging to keep up with what they're up to. But I usually don't have students usually use my sample code to work on their projects, and that really helps a lot too if I provide them with like templates that they can use. And like my projects serve as that too. I have some specific class curriculum stuff, but then like my internet, all my ESP8266 projects, for example, we do that as like a later on exercise in my class, and to build internet connected objects, which is like really fun for product designers, because like what new products these days don't have an angle that wants to connect to the internet in some way or form. So
of course, I think having a shared starting point, shared reference point, like you're talking about, is actually really important. So having that tutorial that people can go back to, it's almost like this sanity check. And so you can, as teaching, so I've also teach remote students, and it's, I feel your pain. It's very difficult. But having that kind of, did you do it the way I did it? Are you sure you did it the way I did it? Because like I said, that branching tree of how many other decisions there are out there. So it can get so bonkers that you have to just, well, we're just going to do it this one way right now, and you can do whatever you want later.
Right. Yeah. Follow along with these steps. So did you go past this step when it said not to go past that step yet? Okay. We'll start there. Yeah, like, right, for sure.
Yeah.
You really got your chain of troubleshooting very formalized.
Yep. So that kind of leads into the documentation side. I mean, this is something that you're very good at. You have many, many tutorials out there. When you're telling someone if you're telling your students how they're going to go and document their projects, what are some like best practices that you've discovered over the years of making content, making tutorials, making things that people follow to like go and replicate the work you've done?
Yeah, I think taking a lot of photos and video is like the first and main step that enables most of the other steps. So if you're not capturing what you're doing at a regular interval when you're doing it, you're not going to have any documentation to work up into a meaningful story to be able to tell. So the first step is getting into that habit, if it doesn't come naturally to you, like it does to me, to be snapping photos and video whenever something cool happens in front of my face, you could set a timer on your phone. That's something I tell my students to do. You're going to work for 3 hours, set a timer for every 15 minutes. And every time the timer goes off, consider, look around, see if there's anything you could take a photo of that is meaningful. Check in with yourself, ask what meaningful progress you've made, document that meaningful progress, set your 15-minute timer again. And that could help you sort of like reflect when big steps have happened if you're documenting them after the fact. And then the other thing that I teach my students to do is to set up a time lapse if they're worried they're going to miss something and they want to capture their process of exploration. Is that if they don't want to have to worry about it in the moment, they could set up a time lapse, and then they'll get individual frames they might be able to pull, but also at the end they'll have at least something that kind of reflects on their experience. So I think capturing and setting up some kind of habits for capturing are really like that's the foundation. If you don't have that content, you can't do anything with no content. And you can't expect yourself to work on the make the content all after you've already had all of the endorphin release from finishing the project. Like that's not going to happen.
Yeah.
So like you have to document it while you're doing it, while you're actually excited about it. Uh-huh. That's it. That's the first one, right? Take photos, take videos. Mm-hmm. Then there's like a couple camera equipment sort of like tips that I have for folks who don't have a background in photography. And the first one is that your light is more important than what camera you have. So if you have a cell phone camera, that's perfectly fine. Just make sure you're shooting next to a window during daytime,
So you have some natural light coming in, and you make sure you have enough light. I mean, you should also be working in a place where you have enough light that you can see what you're doing for your own eyesight. But the camera needs a lot more light than you do to work. So the midnight owls might need to get like a big light to go over your bench if you want to be capturing good stuff with any camera. So like your camera doesn't super matter. Just whatever camera you have. People often get caught up on that. Oh, I don't have a nice camera. Well, cell phones, I think that's starting to die down now that like all cell phones have nice enough cameras, right? But then the other video production tip is that audio is way important than the video quality if you're doing video. People will not be able to watch a video with bad audio the same way that they can watch a video with good audio that has some fuzzy or weird video moments in it. So those are my... Is that three? Two. That's two video production tips. Use a lot of light no matter what camera.
Yeah, if you separate out.
Separate out from the... Right. Gather content. Use natural light if you can. Capture good audio if you're doing anything with audio.
Yeah. Yeah, and I always say with audio
more small tips? Because I have a bunch of small tips too, like wear a GoPro on your head.
I'll take them all. I'll take them all. Yeah, yeah.
I figured out like every manner of rigging the camera overhead to get that like luscious top down shot from like the Manfrotto magic arm to like using a big C stand with a boom arm on it to attaching something to the ceiling. Or like I said, the GoPro, the one that puts it right on your forehead is kind of okay. Yeah, if you,
I was going to say, my life hack was always taking a C920 webcam and just like tucking it into my shirt. And like,
oh, nice. Oh, hey, look at that.
Yeah. So like,
that, then you get like, oh, nice little hands. Yeah.
Yeah. So I use
that. That's super fun. Oh, yeah.
Troubleshooting in front of someone else or like trying to remote, you know, troubleshoot. It's like, it's so tough to do that. But if you have a mobile webcam, that really does help for getting like eyes on a thing. But then you need, like you're talking about, you need good lighting. You need to have maybe control over the exposure so you can like slide it back and forth or focus. So if something is really close, you can rely on autofocus always staying. So yeah, I feel like during COVID specifically, we have everyone's kind of like, oh yeah, I get your pain now, Becky, you know, like now that I live my life. Yeah.
Oh, making an instructional video is actually kind of hard.
Right. So I can't just like get on Zoom and like use my built-in camera. Okay. Well, now what? You know, it's like, okay, well, yeah.
You can use Zoom to record video stuff in your built-in camera if that's what you've got. Just make sure the window is facing your face and not your back.
Right. Yeah, that's true. Yeah. There is a lot of stuff that I've had to learn in that way. I think it is good stuff. I feel like it's like this deep, dark hole. Like I always tell people like watch like one thing about light, like one YouTube video about lighting, but then like ignore any channel that's about like gear. You'll just think you need every new piece of recording
because
gear.
Then you have, because those are for people who want to be lighting professionals. Yeah. I live with a lighting professional and cinematographer.
Oh, okay. Yeah. That'll do it.
That pays its dividends in review of what I'm doing. Right. Like I learn a lot. I set up my own lights and then I ask for advice for improvement.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, okay. So you talked about documenting. I really like that idea of like the, almost like taking a photojournalistic take on your own project. And then at the end, are you just kind of going back through and looking at those every 15 minute shots and saying like, oh, I remember, like, are they like memory hooks for you? Or are you just using those actually to document the project? How are you actually using that photo output?
Well, that photo output tip is for people who don't have the natural impulse to photograph their work all the time.
Okay.
So whatever, they end up with their every 15 minute shots. I have the impulse. It's what got me into this career in the first place, I suppose.
Oh, really?
Okay. I can't stop, won't stop taking photos all the time. Like if I'm doing something that I think is cool, I have this natural impulse to document it in some way so that I can share it with somebody, even if it's just texting a photo to a friend. I have this like, ooh, cool, take a picture. It like pops into my head while I'm working. That happened. Well, and now, you know, I'm in the business of content. So of course I'm not making stuff and like, oh, it's a total surprise to me that I am feeling this urge to take a picture. No, I'm like, I'm in it to make the tutorial from the beginning nowadays. Right. Once I have the photos and videos, I have a process where I'm a pretty visual person. I like to usually do most of the project, film it and take photos, and then reflect on it and write about it. So I don't usually write a ton of before I start a project or even in the middle of a project. I usually use let the photos and videos help remind me of what it was like to do it in the moment, and then use that as a cue for when I'm writing. So I almost feel like my writing style for instructions is like an exaggerated caption for the images and videos that I've captured.
Okay, that's great. Yeah, and I think this is a good opportunity to mention that Becky is a fantastic follow on Instagram, so definitely follow her channel. She shares all of her work there.
Please.
And we'll have links to all this at the end as well. Oh, look, I think we get a preview here of your upcoming project. So
yes, it'll be out by the time this podcast is out. So that's my new project that is already out.
That's great. Yeah. Yeah. That's awesome. Yeah. And I think that, I mean, like I said, I think that documentation piece is something a lot of people don't think about. Like you'd already mentioned like the difficulty of it, but like the importance of it. And then the fact that it's so integral to getting the word out about your work these days. You know, in order to share, you can't just share the end result. People want to see the process. They want to see how you did it. And oftentimes people can then replicate your work and help spread it around after that.
Yeah, I think that's a really important part of my sharing motivation. Like I really value passing along useful skills mixed in with that sort of impetus or inspiration to start or try something new. I don't just want to, sure, I like attention, but it feels selfish if I'm just like, look at this cool thing I made. It feels much more genuine to me to be sharing the process that could help someone see like, oh, that doesn't look as hard as I thought it was. Maybe I could try that. Or they just get an idea about something else entirely. So I'm really into deliberately trying to inspire others with the work that I am doing based on my own interests as well.
That's great. What about people that are coming the other direction? So I have done electronics a long time, but on the craft and the soft goods and things like that, I see uses for it. I see like how I might want to like integrate a piece of electronics I've built like into a piece of clothing. But I'm just like, okay, where do I start? So people coming in the other direction now, maybe interested in electronics, but want to put stuff out in the real world in a different, you know, maybe not just in a plastic box. How do you have people start approaching that side of things?
Oh, it's hard because the folks who know how to make stuff in a plastic box, like we talked about already, they already have some level of confidence about being able to build the thing that's in their head. Mm. But when you change mediums, that ability resets. Yeah. Like you can't expect that just because you can draw a realistic, well, drawing is hard because that is kind of translatable. Just because you can make draw a killer PCB in your favorite PCB software doesn't mean that you're going to be able to draw a portrait of yourself using Adobe Illustrator. Or a pencil, for that matter. So
right.
I think I've heard a lot of, what's the nice way to put it? Folks who, like, their appetite's bigger than their stomach when it comes to combining lots of things.
Overconfidence, perhaps?
And it happens for people who know crafts as well, though, too. They'll be like, I've been sewing quilts for 30 years. How many LEDs is the maximum number of LEDs I could put in this project? By the way, it's my very first electronics project, right? Like that question happens all the time. How many LEDs? And I'd be like, because you're asking that question, I know you're not ready for that many LEDs. So for folks who are coming the other direction, they're often surprised and let down by their own like hand skills when it comes to something like sewing. So I often would try to remind them or I would give the cautionary advice to folks who are already good at electronics or even just interested in electronics who don't know anything about physical crafts to try some physical crafts by themselves before trying to add electronics to said physical crafts. Mm. Because the adding of the electronics to the physical craft, it's a 201 topic above the 101 topic of knowing how to do that craft in the first place. Right? You want to add LEDs to a skirt. Yeah. Have you ever made a skirt before? Maybe try that before you add LEDs to it. It's the skills layer, you're not just going to automatically pick one up. So, but some folks really like to dive in the deep end and dig their way out. And like they learn by swimming up to the surface. So, but that's not the way I like to learn. I don't like to learn through unnecessary frustration. So I would say just try something new. A lot of hand crafts have like analogies in other realms, right? Like knitting and programming have a lot in common. If you're good at programming and you want to try a craft, why don't you try knitting? Because you'll learn the basics of the hand motions are not actually that complicated. The complicated part is reading the pattern, but guess what? The pattern looks like a computer program. So like y'all gonna not have a problem. I do have an intro to knitting class on my site too, in case anyone wants to learn how to knit.
Okay.
So great. Yeah, just try it. Try something new, but don't try to add the electronics right away.
Okay. What are there like, I feel like blinking the LED is the first, you know, that is the 101, that is the getting started in electronics. Maybe getting to blinky, like building a circuit board at some point as well. Like what is the equivalent in like in sewing? Would it be like a pillow, a skirt? I mean, like something.
Yeah, sure. Mm-hmm. Sewing, it would be like a pillow or a scrunchie. Scrunchie is a really good first sewing project.
Yeah.
Because it's small, so even if you want to hand stitch it, it's not going to be like too long of lines. But if you have a sewing machine, yes, a pillow is a very good first project. The embroidery project I will have just released is a very good first embroidery project because it's not very involved. It only uses one color and it won't take that much time. So even if you're really slow, it kind of time boxes the whole thing. Can't kind of get away from you.
Mm-hmm.
And then like, I don't know, let's see, in leather, I think it's a wallet probably. In knitting, it's definitely a scarf.
Okay. Yep. Yeah. That's great to have all those things too. And some of them do seem like, it feels like in the sewing realm, there is more of a kind of an equipment focus as well, but it's probably the same kind of thing as like, you don't need a great soldering iron to get started. You just need a soldering iron. And I think probably the same thing, like you need a sewing machine, but it doesn't need to be like the $3,000 programmable one. You just need to be able to do a straight stitch to start with.
Exactly.
You know,
any old sewing machine that actually sews will do for learning. It's true. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. And you can marvel at how a bobbin works in any of them because that is just you ever seen that like
anime? I could watch that animated GIF for hours. The animated GIF of how a sewing machine bobbin works. And it wasn't around when I was learning how to sew either. My mom tried to explain it to me. She's like, it loops around the bobbin thread. I'm like, yeah, but how does it not get tangled? And
I saw that GIF. The answer is it does. Right, yeah. It just does it very orderly.
Background.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Oh, that's great. That's great. Yeah, it's magical. I'll try and find it and link it in too because it is just so much fun to watch that. So, yeah. What about So someone who's as prolific as you, what about the finishing of projects? Because I feel like that's another thing where, I mean, that's off screen here, but like I have a bench full of electronics and many unfinished projects. So what about getting stuff across the finish line? Obviously there is a documentation element for a lot of the stuff you do, but what about just that final energy? What do you have any takes on that?
I think acknowledging that it's hard is really important. It's definitely true for me. I'm not special in this regard. I know I have an instinct to take photos, but I don't have any special instincts when it comes to finishing projects. I find it just as hard as everybody else. And that last 20% can take 80% of your motivation, if not time. So advice for finishing projects. I do a lot of compromising. So I'm a software product manager at my day job. So like there's a lot of like calculating trade-offs for like, should we build the Papa Bear version of this feature or maybe the Mama Bear version of this feature? So I do a lot of mama bearing of my ideas at the finish line when I'm trying to think like, well, I'd rather publish something than nothing. So I guess that's my mentality is countered. Some people have the thing like, oh, I don't want to put anything out there until it's perfect. But I think of publishing projects. I'm not like a famous film director, but if I equate myself to a film director, it's like, well, do I want to be like a Kubrick, right? Who releases like, I don't know how many, a small handful of like really perfect, impactful films. Do I want to be like more of a, you know, I don't know who's another analogous director, somebody who publishes like a ton of movies and you only like four of them? Well, it might be in the end that you like the same four movies by each, or, you know, four movies from each director. Like which type of director do you align yourself with? So if you can get, you do have to do a bit of psychoanalyzing, like what do you get out of it? If you want to publish four projects a year, like allow yourself to admit that to yourself and then set that as your goal. But if you just like, I don't know, it's not perfect yet, and then you never publish anything, that's bad, right? So I would say that I fall in the other end of the spectrum, where I'm like, well, what, how can I turn this story into something that I can publish, even if it didn't go how I wanted to? How could I talk about the mistake if there was one? Or how could I do it an easy way that also acknowledges there is a place to take this beyond? Because also acknowledging that audiences are inspired by seeing what they would do in the project. Like, if you see a very complete, every aspect, every one of those paths has been taken already, you don't see it yourself in the project. You're like, oh, you're great. Well, how would I ever do anything like that? If you see something that's not quite finished or not quite perfect or not quite the way you would do it, you'd be like, ah, like, ooh, I like this idea, but I would, ooh, you would? You would make it? Oh, okay. And then, like, I think of that. Yeah. I try to remind myself of that. Like, if I, it's okay if my project's not perfect, because that imperfection might inspire somebody more than perfection would have.
Got it. Yeah. So it's like documenting the scars as well, right? So seeing everything that went wrong, because people still take value from that and still getting stuff out in the world. Sounds like also the...
I think setting a schedule is really important, like a schedule that you want to keep yourself to, because if you don't, even if it's, I want to publish four projects this year or one project this year, you need to be able to talk to yourself about realistically when you want to publish and not just someday, because as soon as you put it on your calendar, that's going to like cause you to treat it differently. If you are beholden to your calendar, like some of us are.
Yeah, I was going to say, how do you decide? I mean, like, how many projects you are going to, like, so it sounds like you have a lot of projects. Are you planning out like further into the field, or further into the year of like, by this, maybe I want to do like a St. Patrick's Day project, so I need to start it 2 months ago or something like that.
Yes. You know? Oh yeah. You know me and my annual St. Patrick's Day project.
who doesn't love a good shamrock something, you know?
To a certain extent. Yes. So I have a big list of projects, and some of them have been started in some way or another, but I try not to let myself be haunted by unfinished projects, because I think of them as, well, maybe I'll pick them up again later. But I do think about seasonality a little bit, and like, I have a ham radio antenna project I'm working on. It's like a handheld tape measure Yagi antenna. Well, it's below freezing outside, so I'm going to publish that one when it's a little warmer outside and I can get the B-roll that I want without shivering. So there's very practical concerns like that. Like, don't do an outdoor project in the middle of the winter. But also things like, I do some planning, like, oh, people are into friendship bracelets at the end of the summer, for example. I do try to slot stuff in, and because if I can see what's coming up, I will start to think about it more. Like I said, once it gets on my calendar, it's way easier to sort of see what I need to do to get to the next step.
That's great. That's great.
I also change the calendar around all the time.
Okay. Yeah. I think you have to have that flexibility, and I mean, being able to, it sounds like having the photo documentation as well. It's not like you're like leaving it in a corner. You've kind of probably left it in a spot that you can pick it back up. You do know where you are, but then you've also already had the documentation from a while ago. So it's not like, oh, well, I have to go and reverse populate this board that I made or unplug these wires so I can simulate, you know, being mid process or something like that. So
yeah, that's true. Documentation does serve the purpose of being able to help your future self as well, doesn't it?
Yeah, totally. I mean, I can't name the number of times that I've opened up a piece of firmware and been like, who wrote this? I'm like, oh, it was me. it's never fun. It's never fun. Cursing my past self. That's something I'm not a stranger to. So,
Well, I've been in this attitude of making things easy for my future self for long enough now that, like, lately I've been saying thank you to my past self more than curse you to my past self. And it's been really nice, actually. Yeah. But it's taken years.
How did you get there? Cause I have not gotten that yet.
Well, you have, once you start, that's the thing. Like, you have to start looking out for your future self consistently, and then you don't notice that, like, that doesn't pay off until the inconsistency period like wears off. You know what I mean? Mm. You have to get like,
oh, you have to like once again experience the negative in order to appreciate the good times you had, that kind of idea.
I'm saying it just takes a while to catch up. You have to just start it, okay. And then several years later, you start to the ratio, right? Like it's the ratio of cursing yourself to thanking yourself. It's not going to change overnight. So it takes sustained effort, I'm saying, and I'm finally feeling the payoff.
Yeah, that's great. That's great. So you have a section on your site about tools, and I think that for someone who has such a broad skill set as well, how do you approach kind of having? So I think one of the things is your skill set is a tool set of, you know, like you can apply to all these different projects. So you have sewing and leather work and electronics and coding and all these different things you can push towards different projects. But in the physical realm, how do you prioritize and figure out what tools are going to be useful for each of these realms that you work in?
I don't know, by collecting them and throwing away the ones you don't use after they've sat in your drawer for a long period of time. Okay. So, you know, over time, how to pick out tools. I like to think about what tools I'm using when I think about conceiving of a project that I plan to share, because mm-hmm. I want to have an angle that makes sense. I've had it in the past where projects are supposed to be simple, but have such an expensive bill of materials that it doesn't match up. The messaging and the medium doesn't match up. And that's a shame to me, because then it deflates people when they find out that it's like, this appealed to me and I identified with this so much, but there's this like catch about it. So I like to be upfront about, it would be really genuine with the tool suggestions that I give, and what tools I use. I try to be honest about if I'm using it, like my computerized embroidery machine, right? Try to be honest about how it is to use it and not paint it as a panacea craft supply.
Right. Go ahead and buy this right now. You need this for every project. It's like, well, okay. You
know, like, right. It's like, well, no, I was trying to do this specific thing. And then this was the challenge I had. And so, but there are just some tools that I've had since college, basically, that I just still use every day, like my Olfa knife and stuff, that I just will use it for every project because I know it won't break. And I'm really comfortable recommending that product as well. So I only put tools on my tools page that are tools that I use and like frequently. And I especially get happy when there's a tool that bridges across multiple of the disciplines that I use, because I do have a small shop, so I don't have a ton of space for single purpose tools. Right. I feel that way about the kitchen gadgets too, right? So my heat gun, mm-hmm. for example, awesome heat gun, great for shrinking heat shrink tubing, right? But did you know that you also can use a heat gun for watercolors? No need to wait for your paint to dry between layers if you hit it with the heat gun. And so it's like, okay, now this tool means even more to me because I can use it for two crafts that I like and I only need this one tool. So sometimes mm-hmm. tools will endear themselves to me because they become multi-purpose in a way that only Google understands, you know, or Amazon. Amazon does understand that the heat gun is good for watercolor and soldering, by the way. It figured it out eventually based on, you know, the people who buy it. Yeah, but I love it when that happens. Or my multimeter has an IR thermometer in it. And I never used it much until I went to go make a candle. Oh, well, turns out that the temperature of the wax when you pour it matters a lot. So, and the meat thermometer is too slow. So, my IR thermometer on my multimeter to the rescue for my candle making adventure. Like, that makes me feel good when I can cross-pollinate like that.
Yeah, that's great. That's great. Yeah, because I think about, I was wondering about that with small space as well. I think, again, because we're in COVID times, you know, people are working in spare bedroom, kitchen table, dining room table, you know, like it's just like having a workspace is a luxury that we get. And sometimes we have to just make do. So it feels like that dual use, like you're mentioning, is really important. You post about your workspace as well, of having like this documentation. It's almost like a documentation station where you also happen to work. That kind of is like a interesting look at it. but I think that is really important for having like a efficient workspace for trying out a lot of different ideas.
Yeah.
That's great. So what are you excited about for the future? I mean, what are you hoping to build in the electronics space, in the craft space? What are you hoping to to smush together in 2021 and beyond?
Let me pull out my list for you.
All right. Oh, secret insight here. So notebook is another another tool here.
I'm a two notebook kind of a gal.
Oh, really? Okay.
This is my planner and this is my notebook.
Huh, okay.
My planner has like my calendar and my events of the day, uh-huh. like appointments and stuff. Uh-huh. And my notebook has, I hit my microphone, I'm sorry.
That's right.
And my notebook has my to-do lists and longer form stuff. So I do keep my project ideas in a list. In like every couple of months, I rewrite my project list because it changes over time. I'm working on some more videos for going along with my LED sewing kit. So the Constellation project that it will have just come out is one of those projects. I've got a couple ideas on the books for example projects to show people what they can do with the LED sewing kit. I'm working on a webcam privacy device that's sits on top of the that's computer good. And like a little 3D printed guy and a motor that like makes it more obvious when your camera's covered or not. I'm going to make it like an eyeball and it has like a little eye lid with eyelashes and it'll like come uh-huh. down and cover the webcam. I think that's so that I can like help remind myself in a playful way to keep my webcam covered when I'm not on a call. Because I would like mm-hmm. that to be the default. But you know, like peeling a little post-it note on and off is not nearly as fun as having like a little robot friend.
Yeah, that
so
switch.
I've got you know, that. Like
that's, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Something satisfying and cute and fun to 3D print also. I am going to make a PCB. I know this might sound strange, but I've never made a PCB using software before. I've hand etched like audio amplifiers and stuff with the like Sharpie resist method, but I've never designed anything in CAD. I made like I took an Eagle class once and I made like one footprint for one part. So I'm going to make a PCB. It's going to be a battery holder upgrade for my sewing kit, which I'm using like a bulk battery holder I found, but I think I can bring my bill of materials price down and also have more fun if I make the battery. So that'll be my first PCB project. It'll just be a battery holder with a switch. I feel like that's approachable, awesome. Right? For like baby's first
that's
Eagle
great.
Project.
I think that's a great yeah, that's a great one.
So like I'm trying to paint the perspective of like what it's like to learn how to make a PCB in 2021. I have a particle board in my refrigerator right now because the refrigerator, my landlord doesn't believe that the refrigerator temperature is being inconsistent. And so I'm using the particle to log the temperature so I can be like, oh, look at here. Like once a week it goes above 40 for no reason. And please give us a new fridge. So that's an ongoing project.
So when you say particle board,
I feel like it's just starting to go back.
You mean like a Wi-Fi temperature sensor versus like a, I thought you meant a piece of particle board, like, you know, like the laminated piece of wood. That's what
correct.
I
do mean, I do mean the internet connected microcontroller branded particle. Yes.
Yes. I'm so confused.
But that right now that's just like a solderless breadboard that's like sitting in my fridge. And I would like to make some kind of enclosure for it that's cute and fun. And so that's what's taking me the longest on that project. Like the project actually already works. It just, I just want it to not be a breadboard in the fridge. I'd rather it be like a polar bear or like something fun like that.
Piece of bread, you know, like why not?
Piece of bread. Oh, I could disguise it. Like ooh, maybe I don't have to do any 3D printing. Yeah. Maybe I could just hide it in like a beverage or like a false, well, I don't know. Okay. Thanks for the brainstorm, Chris.
No problem. No
take
problem.
It under advisement.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's the thing. It's not, I'm not trying to hide it like drugs. I'm trying to hide it like not let the ketchup knock the components out of the breadboard.
Yeah, that makes sense. That makes sense. Well, those are some great projects and I'm really excited. I'm always amazed at like your prolific publishing nature. I really enjoy watching all the things you've been building. I think for me personally, you know, seeing like a variety of media as well is like really good because I'm like, oh yeah, electronics don't just have to go in a plastic box. Like that is just something I have to like keep telling myself over and over again. And it's like, and seeing your projects where it's electronics going out in the real world in these different formats, I think is a really important frame in my life. So I really appreciate you doing that. Where can people?
Oh, thanks. That's so nice of you to say. Yeah.
Where can people find you, follow you, make sure they're seeing your next project?
You can go to my website, BeckyStern.com, and sign up for my email newsletter. That way you'll never miss anything that the algorithm decides not to show you. But that said, there's plenty of algorithmic places you can follow me to, specifically my YouTube channel and Instagram would be great. Thank you.
Great. Awesome. Well, thanks so much for joining me, Jet, Becky, and I'm looking forward to that next project.
Thanks.
So that's our show with Becky Stern. I really loved hearing about all of the projects she's making, all of the future things she's planning on making, and hearing how to integrate electronics in a shell that isn't just that plastic case like I kept mentioning. The thing that my first instinct is to go take electronics and then just go and put them in a case. And I love hearing from people like Becky who take it and put electronics out in the world in different and useful ways. You can follow Becky on Instagram and YouTube, and I highly recommend you do. She's a great person to follow. You'll be inspired for your own projects. You'll get to see someone working on really cool projects, and you can go and follow the tutorials she's making so you can even just do what she does. And I think that that is a great method for learning new areas. I'm excited to go and try in some of those getting started projects like she mentioned, and I hope you do too. That's all for now. Thank you for supporting the Contextual Electronics podcast. Please do share with all your friends, YouTube links, audio, whatever's out there. We've got Spotify. On the audio side, we've got Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts. You can find it just about anywhere. If you can't, please send us an email, podcast@contextualelectronics.com. We have the YouTube link, and we also have our website. Please do check that out. There's a forum as well if you want to discuss this episode. That's all for now. Thanks for watching. We'll see you in the next video.